Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, state leaders respond to the rollback of federal protections that allow transgender students to use the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity.
President Trump and his administration made good on another reckless promise. Sadly, at this point, it's nothing new. But here's what's different. He went after children.
Plus, what if you were able to fix your broken smartphone yourself? New legislation might allow you to do just that. And what drives our compulsions to tweet, shop, and constantly check our phones?
I was in my car one time, and a Bruce Springsteen song comes on. And I go, okay, I'm getting sad. I've got to get the phone and write hi to like 50 people.
A new book looks at the anxieties behind our compulsions. Also today, we visit the hidden sacred spaces of Greater Boston. That's Radio Boston after this hour's news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Let's follow up on the Trump administration decision to rescind protections for transgender students. This was a rule the Obama administration put in place last year, which allows students to use bathrooms that correspond with their gender identity. The Trump administration says that directive was improperly devised, quote, without due regard for the primary role of the states and local school districts in establishing educational policy. Well, state leaders are responding, saying they'll uphold the state's anti-discrimination laws. Here's Governor Charlie Baker.
I don't support the message, and I don't believe it's the right message, but I do believe that here in the Commonwealth of Mass, kids are going to be protected, and kids are going to be able to feel safe and secure in the communities that they live in and the schools they go to.
WBUR's Edify reporter Max Larkin was at the Attorney General's office for the press conference with legislative leaders and LGBTQ activists, and he joins us now live. Hi, Max.
Hi, Tanya.
So tell us, what did Attorney General Healey say about all of this?
She said that the administration had made good on what she called another reckless promise, and yet she said this time it's different because both the president and the Department of Justice went after children. And I'd say the tone from the stage where families and parents of transgender youth were gathered was hopeful but defiant. The Attorney General was clear that the rollback won't affect students in the state, but nonetheless, she said students across the country and in Massachusetts are feeling anxious and scared today. She kept hitting that tone. She said she thought it was both shameful and remarkable that this was new Attorney General Jeff Sessions' first major action in office.
I saw that she was up at the podium with several students as well as supporters. And also there was Speaker Robert DeLeo and State and Senate President Stan Rosenberg. Did they weigh in at all?
They did and presented very much a united front. President Rosenberg added that state lawmakers have protected Massachusetts students because they've already, quote, done their job with two pieces intended to curb anti-transgender discrimination signed in the last 5 years. And Speaker DeLeo was a little bit more to the point. He said he thought the, quote, well-oiled machine of the Trump administration may be ready for the scrap heap.
One of the things that many people are wondering, in light of the fact that Healey has already filed three suits against Trump in the first 10 days of the administration, is whether she's actually planning any legal action or challenge to this this latest action.
Yes, the Attorney General was asked about the prospect of taking part in federal litigation, and she said that she expects that her office will be involved on cases where it comes to a matter of fairness and equal protection under the law, but it's sort of unclear to what role she foresees for her office.
Last spring, during the debate over the Massachusetts accommodation bill, we spoke with Andrew Beckwith. He's the president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, which opposes the law.
If we normalize the presence of anatomical males in spaces that are typically reserved for women, intimate spaces, that endangers both the safety and the privacy of women.
That's the argument on the other side from many folks. Did Healy say anything about those concerns that some people have about safety?
Healy was very clear from the stage that she thought that was sort of fundamentally a red herring. She said this isn't about states' rights or presidential power or the ability to make decisions in local school districts. She said it's about the, quote, targeting of an already vulnerable population. And Mimi LeMay, who is the parent of three children, one of whom is a transgender boy, Jacob, said that she believed that the guidance issued by the State Department of Education left room for concerns about safety and privacy to be addressed within school. But to say that issuing anti-discrimination guidance has to do directly affects or limits the safety of other students is disingenuous.
Looking forward, a question to repeal the Massachusetts accommodations law is set to appear on the ballot next year, and the Attorney General ruled that legally that question could go before voters. Did she talk anything about that, and did she indicate in any way that we may see that she may fight the repeal?
The Attorney General is very clear that part of the reason that she convened the news media and all of these advocates in her office today was that she considers transgender discrimination a live issue, and she considers it a live issue because of that ballot question. Now, her office is obliged to certify that language of the question is legal, mm-hmm. but she said she feels perfectly free as the Attorney General and as an office to oppose the question, and she anticipates that she, Speaker DeLeo, and Senate President Rosenberg all will do just that. Absolutely, she said.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Max. Max Larkin is a reporter for WBUR's Edify. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tanya.
All right, so the trade deadline for the NBA passed just a few moments ago at the top of the hour. Let's now turn to WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Spinger for the latest in the world of sports. Hi, Shira.
Hello, Tanya.
So, yes, 3 o'clock came and went. And do we know anything about the Celtics and any local big trades?
Well, it doesn't seem like the Celtics have made any big trades, though some do trickle in, or I should say news of some trickle in after the deadline. So I say we have until about 3:15, 3:20 to see if there are actually any big deals. But all signs were pointing toward the Celtics standing pat for now and waiting till free agency and the draft to build the team of the future, what they hope will be a championship-winning team. There were some other teams making big deals, and it's worth noting that the 76ers traded Everett native Nerlens Noel to the Dallas Mavericks. Mm. The Dallas Mavericks also have another Celtics connection in that they are coached by Rick Carlisle, a former Celtic who is a prodigy of Red Auerbach. And since you're from Detroit, Chuck Daly of
my
the Pistons.
Heart
I know.
Still,
so I thought I should get a Detroit mention in there for you. So that'll be an interesting move. That the Dallas Mavericks are building toward the future with Nerlens Noel, and we'll see how that goes. But so far, nothing for the Celtics, but it doesn't mean that the whole trade deadline buildup hasn't been without drama.
That's right. That's right. Everyone's focused now on stuff like Twitter. So
I know.
Isaiah
it's crazy.
Thomas.
It's a bit of the silly season, I always think, with the way players put out tweets. And you were mentioning
that's
Isaiah
right.
Thomas.
So Isaiah Thomas tweeted these eyeballs, so which are
the shifty
like
eyeballs.
Shifty eyes.
Yeah.
And everyone's going crazy, like, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does it mean?
Apparently nothing. But the last time Isaiah Thomas tweeted those shifty eyeballs, the Celtics did sign Al Horford. So people thought, ooh, maybe something big
so
is going on.
Background there. Okay.
But I think Isaiah Thomas was playing with Celtics fandom a little bit, having a good little laugh at their expense, perhaps. It's worth noting, though, that as soon as Isaiah Thomas put out that tweet, the assistant general manager for the Celtics, Mike Zarin, got about 20 calls from people around the league wondering what's going on
because
not only fans, but people on the inside of the NBA thought, maybe Isaiah Thomas does know something.
Dun, dun, dun. The shifty eyes. Like, people are really worried. Yes. Well, let's shift now to the Olympics, the 2024 Olympics, because yet there is another city that has withdrawn the bid to host the Games. Budapest withdrew yesterday, adding its name to the growing list of cities that say thanks but no thanks to the Olympics. And of course, we know that Boston dropped its bid for the Games back in August of 2015 after the public spoke loud and clear and said they didn't want the hassle that goes with bringing Games here. So why'd Budapest drop their bid?
I think a lot of the same reasons Boston dropped its bid and a lot of other cities have dropped theirs. They don't want the hassle, they don't want the cost, and they see no long-term upside for hosting the Olympic Games. And so now, like there was for the 2020 Olympic bidding process, the Winter Olympic bidding process, there are only two cities left for the 2024 Summer Olympics, Los Angeles and Paris. There's some popular sentiment that one should be given the 2024 Olympics and one should be given the 2028 Olympics, and just let's kind of reconfigure and rethink the whole bidding process in the interim so the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, doesn't have the embarrassment of cities dropping out left and right. Personally, I think there actually needs to be a bigger solution to this problem, because I think it's going to be a continuing problem, because it is simply too expensive for these cities, whether they're a mid-sized city, a large city, whether there are reforms put in place to recycle venues. It doesn't matter. It's too much to ask cities to host these games these days. I think you need to start thinking about having permanent sites. I think you name five permanent sites. I think you put one on each continent. You know, you have a Sydney site, a European site, an Asian site,
That's
a North American site, and a South American site.
Have folks seriously talked about that?
This has been talked about before, and I think it sort of goes against the International Olympic Committee's desire to expose the Olympics to different communities and different cultures and introduce the world to different countries. And, you know, because it's not just the sports that you see. You also get a sense of the host country, and it allows that host country to shine. But at this point, the host countries and host cities are so burdened by debt and by these venues that become white elephants afterwards that you're really doing these host cities a disservice. Plus, there's this tremendous ramp up when you're hosting Olympics, and you only get one shot at it.
That's right.
Imagine if you had this tremendous ramp up and then you got a shot at it every 15 or 20 years. So the things that you didn't quite iron out the first time around, you could fix the next time around. I think it would also help the coaches and the people who plan, whether it's, you know, Olympic committees or media members, and they could say, okay, we have some familiarity with what we're getting into rather than starting from scratch with each Olympic game. So something to consider, permanent sites.
Right. What a change. I remember the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, and it was such a big deal because there was lots of infrastructure changes and so much excitement around it and what it would bring to a city. So to be at this point now, we're really seeing a shift in really how our society works today.
Yes,
and the
exactly.
challenges there. So let's go towards the Boston Marathon and take a look at some big news out of what's happening there. So we're 53 days away, and elite runner Shalane Flanagan has announced this week that she's dropping out due to a back fracture?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really sad story. I have watched Shalane Flanagan since she competed in the Beijing Olympics and was a bronze medalist, I'm going to say, in the 10,000 meters, if my memory serves me correctly. She is one of the all-time greats in American women's distance running. She fractured her back. It was a combination of the snow she received at her training base in Portland, Oregon, and trying to run in slippery conditions and then spending too much time on the treadmill. It was hoped that she might be able to break the drought of American female winners. American women have not won the race since 1985.
Right.
So it was hoped that she could do it. Now everybody's hopes will be pinned on another American runner, Desiree Linden.
Oh, Desiree Linden.
Yes.
All right.
So there is still hope.
There is still hope. Okay, so this wouldn't be sports without talking about the New England Patriots. Even though we're weeks away from the epic Super Bowl win, people are still talking about dun-dun-dun, Tom Brady and that jersey. And apparently he won't stop talking about it either, right?
So I know,
he's been
on
social media talking about, hey, who has my jersey? But it might be worth a lot of money. So the police report valued it at $500,000.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a lot, but I still think that's undervaluing it. I mean, you're talking about the biggest comeback in Super Bowl history, perhaps the biggest comeback in all of sports by perhaps the greatest NFL player of all time. $500,000, it sounds low to me, but I love what Brady is doing in terms of identifying suspects, including, jokingly, his own teammate, Julian Edelman,
right.
His dog, Scooby. I think he also identified Jaws, the shark, as a possible suspect. He's having a little bit of fun with this.
Shira, what if he found out, like, he had his car cleaned one day and he saw it, like, underneath the seat, balled up, you know, all of this workup for something like that?
I have a lot of explaining to do.
I know, right? Exactly. And then there is
this video that's on the front page of the Globe. Everybody's talking about it.
I feel like we should have a warning before we tell Patriots fans about this. Please be seated when you hear about what Tom Brady did.
I know. So Tom Brady posted a video where he's skiing down a slope to a big jump and he takes a spill. And it's a big spill, right?
Yeah. So he kind of takes a pretty hard tumble down the slopes.
Yeah, and he mixed in some sound from an old episode of South Park. Let's take a listen.
Okay, ski down to me.
Bye.
Okay, you see what he did? He french fried when he should have pizza. French fried when you pizza, you're going to have a bad time.
Okay, we posted this video on our website, and I like to joke that, like, there's Brady's not 1,000 yards away from pizza or french fries ever, right? Yeah. But he pizzaed and french fried, or whatever that means, on the
He took a pretty bad spill, and, you know, I think everybody who's a Patriots fan, their heart stopped in much the same way their heart stopped when he went cliff diving during one offseason. So just, I think Patriots fans would like to say to Tom Brady, cool it a little bit on the daredevil skiing and the cliff jumping, maybe stick with the water sliding, which he has done, and the bad dance moves, perhaps. Right. Just, you know, keep your feet on the ground.
Or maybe chill out for just
one
just day.
Put your feet
with
up.
With a pizza and some french fries.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, Shira Springer is WBUR sports and society reporter. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. Coming up, we look at a bill that could let you crack your phone and fix it yourself. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Either you or someone you know has broken their smartphone.
Hey, why didn't you get me from the hospital? I sent you like 100 texts. Jerk.
Jerk? What? Oh, hey, they're coming in now, sweetie.
Wait, you fell off your bike? Went to the hospital. You broke your arm.
That's an ad from T-Mobile featuring Bill Hader. We've all been there. There's a glitch in the call function. App shuts down. All of a sudden, whatever it is, you probably had to schedule an appointment with Apple or Samsung or Microsoft. Or maybe you had to pay a lot of money out of pocket to get it fixed. But what if you could fix that glitch on your phone all on your own? Lawmakers across the country are racing to get digital right to repair bills passed, including right here in Massachusetts. Joining us now from the Boston Globe is Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the business section of the Globe. Hi, Hiawatha.
Hi.
So you wrote about these digital right to repair bills in your column in the Globe this week. What exactly is this and what would it do?
Well, yeah, basically, it's very simple in its concept. It is that if you make an electronic product that can be repaired and that your company ordinarily repairs, you will make available the tools, parts, diagnostic software, whatever kinds of equipment you need to repair it, so that others can buy that exact same equipment and offer repair services independently of you. Mm. It's exactly what the auto industry now has to do. And remember, for years, there was this huge controversy. Independent repair shops said that they didn't have full access to all the parts, equipment, software, etc., needed to fix modern cars because the car companies wouldn't share that. They fought tooth and nail, but here in Massachusetts in 2012, referendum passed that established the I'm pretty sure it was the first in the country, right to repair principle in Massachusetts law. Car companies had to provide that stuff to any company willing to pay for it. And once it was passed in this one state, the car companies threw up their hands and said, great, we're going to do it nationwide.
That's right.
And so now, if you need that information, you can get it. Well, there's a movement afoot to try to do the same thing with digital devices. Now, early on, you said people could fix their phones themselves. I don't think anybody's going to fix their phones themselves.
There might That's be not some really folks, the, some tech folks.
There might be some.
Yeah.
But the main thing that people are interested in is making it easier for independent shops to get all of the equipment, know-how, software, et cetera, that they need so that they can fix it. And that means there are far more places where you can get your devices fixed. They will have far higher quality equipment and standards. They'll do a better job, and the price of getting repairs will go down.
So I'm embarrassed to say, but I've broken my smartphone over the years like 5 times, and I've taken it to these companies like iFixit instead of the maker of the phone. Now, how does this work, and is that legal?
Oh, it's quite legal. It's just that these companies basically had to teach themselves how to do it. Here's what iFixit does. They buy everything on the market they can get their hands on and deliberately tear it apart. They videotape it and they analyze in great detail everything you have to do to put it back together. And then they write manuals on how to do it. They have to reverse engineer everything because Apple, Samsung, etc., doesn't provide that information. They've done it for about 7,400 items out there. But as I point out in my column today, this year alone at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, 20,000 new products were introduced. There's just no way that this is the satisfactory solution to this problem. What you need is some way that you can get that information from the manufacturer whenever the manufacturer wants it. And it's not just smartphones, too. If you read the column, which of course you did, you notice that I lead off with an example of a state legislator in Nebraska that is pushing this, and she was not brought into it because of her smartphone. It was because of her $300,000 tractor for plowing her cornfield.
Yes, so let's talk about this. So it started with this tractor owner who wanted to be able to fix her equipment when it was broken. Tell us a little bit more about her story.
She and her husband farm 1,000 acres in Nebraska, and they have a combine made by a company called Case IH. Costs $300,000, but to fix it, you have to have special diagnostic tools that plug into the systems, to the tractor's computer systems. You cannot fix it without this. Now, people have been complaining about this in the farm industry for years now. The big, the most famous example is John Deere. Traditionally, farmers often fix their own equipment, but they can't because they cannot even plug into the tractor and access the software. And John Deere has warned them that if they try to reverse engineer it or hack it, they would be in violation of copyright law and could even be sued for doing it. They say you must come to an authorized John Deere dealer to get anything fixed. And it's been driving farmers crazy. And that's what started this in Nebraska. But then they said, hey, while we're at it, let's do it for smartphones, too, and everything else. And so Apple gets on a plane and goes to Lincoln, Nebraska, and starts talking to the senator and says, hey, we don't mind you doing it with farm implements, but leave phones out of it. Write a little section of the bill that exempts smartphones.
So that was my next
way.
That was my next question for you. What are these big tech companies saying in response to this proposed legislation, not just Nebraska, but in all of these other states as well?
That's right. Well, they're saying that it could conceivably make it easier for people to hack. They were telling this woman, the senator I talked to in Nebraska, Nebraska will become a mecca for hackers. I mean, you just imagine all these people in hoodies getting off the plane in Omaha. It's amazing. And they're saying that hackers will be able to more easily break into the phones. They're saying that these people will do bad work, that the phones will burst into flames, that people are better off bringing their stuff to authorized dealers that they approve of. But of course, the auto industry made the same argument about right to repair with cars, about how it wouldn't be safe to get your car fixed at just any repair shop. But people have been doing that forever. And now it's easier to do it because all the data is provided to the mechanics and there's no sign that it's hurt consumers at all. But yes, the major consumer electronics organizations are all opposed to this. They don't want this to happen.
So you mentioned the law that passed here in 2012 and how it really reformed the nation. It followed the automakers adopted Massachusetts standards nationwide. What
That's
is
right.
your sense of the likelihood of these bills passing? And then really like the greater sense, if they pass, say, in all of these states or even just one or two, what the significance of that could be?
Well, personally, I think you'll see the same thing happen, because if they have to do this, if they have to have the parts available for others to buy just in one state, why not do it nationwide? If one state does it, first there's going to be the issue of popularity. This is going to be a popular measure. It's probably going to pass any place it really comes to a vote. Sooner or later, it will be enacted into law, and then other states will do it. So if it catches on in one state, it'll probably catch on in others. And if it catches on in any one state, they're going to have to do it anyway. So I think they'll just go ahead and say, oh, what the heck, let's go for it. I think that's why they're flying out to Nebraska, because they're thinking, oh, no, this could be the state.
So this could happen very soon for us where we
I don't know how soon, but it would make our lives better. It would make it easier and cheaper for us to keep our products in working form. And I just can't think of a good argument against it.
Hiawatha Bray is the technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. He wrote about digital right to repair in his column today in the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. Been a pleasure.
So, of course, maybe we wouldn't have to keep fixing our phones if we weren't so obsessed with them. According to a new study by the American Psychological Association, nearly half of Americans say they are checking their emails, texts, or social media accounts constantly. And I am guilty. I am one of those folks. And while it's probably not surprising to you, what you might be surprised by is the reason we can't stop checking. Sharon Begley has written a book about why so many of us are constant checkers and what drives our compulsions, from tweeting to online shopping to hoarding. Begley is a senior science writer for STAT, the life sciences publication of the Boston Globe, and she's written a new book called Can't Stop: An Investigation of Compulsions. It covers the broad spectrum of compulsions, from the very mild to the life-altering. And she joins us now in studio. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you, Tanya.
So I am really fascinated by this subject. And most of us have seen firsthand or heard of compulsive behaviors before. But you say there is a spectrum. I'd like for you to describe that.
There definitely is. From the mild, which I think most of us have some form of, to the extreme, where it's diagnosable, it's a recognized psychiatric disorder, and it can really impair your life and cause you huge distress. So at the extreme would be something like obsessive compulsive disorder. But the more mild form would be, let me give you an example of someone from the book, someone who just feels she needs a little island of calm, tranquility, and order in her home because the outside world is crazy and uncontrollable. So by God, her home is going to be, right. You know, she's compulsive about how she arranges her teacups and her dining room chairs, how the bath towels hang. Mm-hmm. And again, she was able to articulate this. The outside world is beyond my control, but I am going to have an island of calm, serenity, and control here where I live. And she feels compulsive about doing that.
On this idea of our technologies, comedian Louis C.K. Had a bit on the Conan O'Brien show from September 2013 where he talked about this a bit. Let's hear a little bit of that.
You need to build an ability to just be yourself and not be doing something. That's what the phones are taking away.
Yes.
Is the ability to just sit there. Because, you know, underneath everything in your life, there's that thing, that empty, forever empty. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're alone. You know, it's down there. And that's why we text and drive. I look around, pretty much 100% of people driving are texting.
Yes.
And they're killing, everybody's murdering each other with their cars.
Yes.
But people are willing to risk taking a life and ruining their own because they don't want to be alone for a second.
That really gets me in the gut. Is that forever empty just another description for anxiety?
It is. And, you know, Louis C.K. could be running a psychology department because there actually was an experiment in which people were given the choice of either no phone or an electric shock. And people preferred the mild electric shock. You know,
no.
It wasn't. They said, no, I would rather have the mild electric shock than for you, the researcher, to take my smartphone away from me for even like 20 minutes. We weren't talking about going without it for a week. So we are absolutely tied to our electronic devices. And exactly as you said, Tanya, the underlying motivation, emotion, is anxiety, that when we don't have them in our hands, when we can't check them constantly, this intolerable anxiety just rises up in us. And then, of course, the question is, where does that come from? FOMO, fear of missing out, is now so common. It has its own acronym. The feeling that if we are not constantly checking, some amazingly fascinating or important thing is going on that we're not aware of. And the other little thing, again, how we, you know, can't stand to be without them, to Louis C.K.'s point, we're really bad at being alone with our own thoughts. Mm. And it's so easy to just not have to face that if you can just look at your screen.
Right. Okay, so we need to have callers call in about this because I know people might have a lot of questions for you. So are some of these compulsions familiar to you out there, our listening audience? How do you deal with your anxiety? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston as well. So going back to that idea of anxiety, I think for me that really brings about this idea that maybe this is not some sort of clinical disorder. So doesn't it mean we have a pathology in many ways? Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
I'd put it slightly differently. Something that I say in the book is that just because you have a compulsion does not mean that your brain is broken. In fact, compulsion is often a way to defuse anxiety that we all feel for, you know, just because that's how the world is. So it's what scientists call an adaptive response. It's a way, again, to sort of drain away anxiety that you would otherwise feel. You know, to repeat myself, once it gets to be distressing and impairing your life, then you have segued into an actual mental disorder. But there are just tons of compulsions that are well short of us and that actually serve us very well.
So your book focuses a lot on compulsions that are not the classic obsessive compulsive disorders. But you did talk to people that were diagnosed with OCD and why they felt compelled to do what they do. Can you share a little bit of light on those compulsions?
So OCD is an unusual mental disorder because it is characterized by the technical term is it's ego dystonic, which simply means that with one little part of your brain, even as another part of your brain is telling you your hands are covered with germs, so go wash them for the 57th time that day, or you left the front door open, so you have to go running back on your way to work and check that it really is locked, or the stove is on, all these things that are characteristic of OCD. With a little part of your brain, you're getting the message, I really know that that's not the case. Mm. So people are just hugely torn. They're getting the strong message, uh-oh, wash your hands or check the stove. But they really know that they just checked the stove. They just checked the door. They just washed their hands. So that's why it can be so, so alarming. So I talked to many people with OCD, and it shows up in some of the oddest ways. One woman was convinced that her cat was locked in the refrigerator. And she would check once. You know, accidents can happen. Maybe Fred really
right,
was
in
the refrigerator.
Right, got in there by mistake,
you know?
Yeah.
So she checked. He wasn't there. All was good. And then, you know, she waited a few minutes, and then she thought, what if he was actually behind the huge gallon jug of milk? I better check again. So she could not tear herself away from checking, which is obviously not a good way to spend the afternoon. And the hoarders I spoke with, again, just the inability to let go of anything. The general reason is anxiety, but each of them had their own uniquely personal stories about where that anxiety came from.
So we have some folks that have called, and some of them are really interested in this idea of tying social media with compulsions or with anxiety. So Norlene says there are two sides for her in this. Norlene?
Yes. How are you?
Hi, how are you? You were saying that there are two sides of the story for you on this idea of compulsion and your devices, for instance.
Yes. So, for example, you know, in years gone by, in like 40 years ago, when I started in the working world, we didn't have phones back then. And also, right around that time, we typically worked 40 hours, went home, and that would be it until the next day. But in today's climate, you, especially if you're salary paid, you tend to be working around the clock for whatever reason to keep pace with, that's just the way it is. And so we are forced to be tied to these electronic devices. And the flip side of it is, because of that same reason, I, for one, cherish the thought when you're able to just put it aside, shut it off, put it aside, and get more personal with people around you.
Norlene brings up an excellent point. Thank you so much, Norlene. This idea that we have to be on because of our jobs, they require it. FOMO, that's what you were talking about.
And if we're not on, then by ignoring it or by turning it off, again, anxiety that we are missing an important message or order from our boss. Mm-hmm. So again, it's anxiety. And actually, Tanya, when I started the book, one of the motivations was just, so I work in a newsroom, of course, just seeing that I, my friends, my colleagues, we can't go to the restroom without the phone because, again, yeah. You are just filled with anxiety that you're going to miss an important call from a source or your boss or whatever. And you mentioned that compulsions are different from addictions. Addictions, you know, say what you will about them, and I don't mean to belittle them, but at least they are born out of a sense of joy and fun, and you actually like them. You know, you're addicted to chocolate, or you're addicted to gaming, or you're addicted to even gambling. With compulsions, there's not a lot of joy there. And again, I would, you know, refer you to, as the caller said, to how we feel tethered to our digital devices. It doesn't feel fun. It doesn't feel like we love it. It feels like we have to. And if we don't do it, it's anxiety.
Right. We can't stop. We have Doug. He's calling from Natick. And Doug, you say you have no anxiety. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I'm not the least bit worried about missing anything important. I'm not only not anxious about being alone, in fact, I'm desperate to be alone with my thoughts, in part because I'm writing a book. And as your guest knows, if you're writing a book, it requires a lot of attention and thought, and you can't be disturbed by phone calls or looking at your phone. In fact, all of my incoming phone calls are automatically go to my voicemail. I check it once a day. All of my email automatically gets saved, and once a day I look at my 300 emails. So I don't feel a sense of anxiety except when I am forced to look at my phone because my boss says, you know, we're going to need to be on the phone a lot now, and that, you know, then I have anxiety because I'm forced to have this stupid phone injected into my life. And lest you think that I'm a technological troglodyte or something, I have a PhD in computer science. I have a PhD in electrical engineering. I've been in the computer business designing computers since for about 45 years. So not only am I not an old fogey who doesn't get it, I'm still designing computers as a consultant for the Defense Department. So I'm still on top of technology more than most people, and yet I don't fit into this category that your guest is talking about.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you very much. So is Doug like an anomaly, or is that...
Well, I would say Doug has the right idea, and we should all try a little harder to emulate him. The reason why it's so hard to do that is that our electronic devices, whether it's text or emails or the latest post on Facebook or the latest amazing tweet, they have a characteristic that psychologists call variable intermittent rewards, which simply means a lot of them can come in. You know, most of the texts that you get, certainly most of the tweets that you see, you really would have been just fine ignoring them, as Doug told us. But every once in a while, there's one that's really, really good. Mm-hmm. And variable intermittent rewards are the sort of slot machine model. Mm-hmm. You know, you pull and pull and pull in the old kind before they were all electronic. And usually it would just be, lemon, cherry, whatever. You'd get nothing. But every once in a while, it was a jackpot. And that's exactly what social media is like in its reward structure. You might have just checked all your email, but you can't be sure that a new one just came in the last 5 seconds, and it is, going to transform your life, or at least be, interesting and fun. So that's why, again, the human mind is structured in a way that makes it really, really hard to resist variable intermittent rewards.
It's just really, it opens up so much for me, this idea that it's just sort of a natural human trait, part of the human condition, that we're wired to respond and want that type of gratification.
You know, really, that was one of the messages that I hope readers come away with, because I think it's very easy to belittle, to make fun of people who behave compulsively. Certainly hoarders have been on the receiving end of that with many of the cable shows. But what I hope is that people look inside themselves at least a little bit, recognize some of their own compulsions, and have a greater understanding of and maybe even sympathy for people in their lives who they see behaving compulsively, understand where it comes from. And of course, if you understand it in your own life, then you have, at least a fighting chance of overcoming it if you want to.
Let's take one more call because you're really popular. We have Shannon, and she's calling from Milton. And she's talking about her phone in her purse and the anxiety around that. Shannon.
Well, I don't just worry that my phone isn't in my... So, for example, I have my purse, and I say, oh, do I have my phone? I can't just open my purse and see my phone. I have to touch my phone. It's very, and it's starting to be, it takes a lot of time. Car keys, same thing. Wallet, I can't just say, oh, yeah, there they are. I have to touch them.
Thank you for that. So you need to, touch your phone for reassurance is what you're saying, kind of just to make sure that it's there.
I guess that's what it is. It's just, annoying because it takes up so much time.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Shannon. Let's have one more caller. We have Sam. He's calling from Harvard. And he says he has a lot of anxiety when he does not have his phone. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Yeah, I got, I just have, like, this major OCD. It's, like, almost like OCD. Like, the red banners on the top of the apps have to be gone by the time I go to bed. And if I don't have my phone on me, it's a whole other issue because I get almost full-blown panic attacks because I already have an anxiety disorder. So it's, like, really hard for me not to have it. Like, I always have to have it and know that it's there.
Mm. What do you say to that? That idea that he can't even go to sleep until he knows that they're all clear.
You definitely have a more difficult to deal with form, a definitely more extreme form of it. But again, human behavior exists on this spectrum, as we were saying earlier. And if you're at the extreme end, it's really, really tough. You know, one of the interesting things about the previous caller and having to touch it, I just go back to the woman I interviewed who couldn't believe her eyes that Fred, her cat, was not in the refrigerator. Sometimes we can't believe our eyes, and we need to feel that darn thing to be sure that it's in our purse.
There is this idea of having a simpler life, and maybe really this excess and this access that we have to excess contributing to our need and our want to continue to fulfill that. Is that something that is a Western phenomenon, and is it a true thing?
I don't think we can call it Western anymore now that so much of this has permeated non-Western countries. But absolutely, there is a recognition that things have perhaps gone too far. So that's why you see, you know, events like the National Day of Unplugging, you know, San Francisco Unplugged, especially for digital media, just efforts to somehow wean people from their, you know, digital crutches. I'm going back to one of the earlier callers who said that he will go to the end of the day before checking emails. So that's one of the ways you can try to do it. So, like, don't go cold turkey, but see if you can sleep overnight without having your phone on, or see if you can get through a dinner with friends without the phone on. Again, not telling you to go 24/7 without it, but see if you can do it for just, you know, an hour or a few minutes. And if you then get the message from that experience that the world did not end,
right.
If you were able to, you know, sort of keep your anxiety under control, then that might give you the wherewithal to dial back even further.
Sharon Begley, thank you so much for joining us. Sharon is the senior science writer at STAT, the life sciences publication of the Boston Globe. Her new book is Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions. Thank you so much, Sharon.
Thank you, Tanya.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Across Greater Boston, more than 50 sacred spaces are hidden away in places and spaces you might not expect. From Our Lady of the Airways at Logan Airport in Boston, to the Hebrew Senior Life Synagogue in Rosendale, to the Muslim Prayer Room at Massachusetts General Hospital, sacred spaces exist as places of silence and prayer across the Commonwealth. And many of these sacred spaces have evolved over the years to reflect the changing culture of Boston. Wendy Kadge, professor of the sociology department of Brandeis University, has been working to explore and document these places for a special project launched last year called Boston's Hidden Sacred Spaces. And she joins us now. Wendy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So what made you decide to start cataloging sacred spaces here in Boston?
The spark for this idea came from a collaboration with Carla Johnson, who is a principal architect at Johnson Roberts and Associates in Somerville, and architectural historian Alice Friedman, who teaches at Wellesley College. We had collaborated on some projects and had the idea to start to document these spaces a few years ago. Unfortunately, Carla became ill and passed away just about a year ago. And Alice and I wanted to continue this project really in her honor mm-hmm. and to recognize the way that she, in her design and just in her person, taught us to pause.
Mm-hmm. And so this is about honoring her with this project as well.
It really is. We were blessed to have a photographer, Randy Armour, join us. He's a longtime Boston photographer and educator, knows the city well. And he and I have spent the last 6 to 8 months driving through the city, seeking out these spaces, photographing them. And really, we want to share these photographs with the people of Boston in Carla's honor and in the hopes that it can help all of us pause and appreciate kind of where we are today.
What makes a space sacred? That can mean a lot of different things to many different people.
So we decided for this project that we were only going to look at spaces that people in organizations designated themselves as being religious or spiritual. Mm. So for many people, perhaps the pond in Jamaica Plain is spiritual or sacred. But for the purposes of this project, we decided to look at institutions and look at the chapels, meditation, and prayer rooms that they themselves called spiritual or religious.
I see. So tell us about some hidden spaces that we may not know about that are hidden away in different corners of the city.
Great question. So we've got photographs of 50 of them up on our website, hiddensacredspaces.org, that we hope people will look at. My personal favorites, at Logan Airport, we in Boston actually have the first airport chapel in the United States.
Really?
It was built first in 1951 by Archbishop Richard Cushing. It was rebuilt in 1965 and remains there today much as it has been. I think this is a kind of hidden space because many of us have been through Logan, but how many have actually stopped at the chapel to take a peek?
Mm-hmm.
That's one. Many of our area universities have chapels. At Northeastern, there is a space they call the Sacred Space that was literally built on the ashes of a very sort of traditional Protestant chapel that burned in the 1990s, and they built the sacred space in response.
Do you have any favorites along the way doing this project?
Yeah, my personal favorite is the chapel at Harvard Business School, which is an interesting place to find a chapel, and I like its aesthetics. It has running water moving through, it has plants, it has fish. For me, it's a very peaceful place to sit. But Randy and I have spent a lot of time as we've been driving through Boston talking about which ones we'd pick and which ones are our favorites.
You've said that this is a story about how and where religion and spirituality have been present in Boston and how the city has changed with the wave of immigrants. How do these sacred spaces reflect how Boston has changed?
It's interesting to look at how some of the specific spaces have changed. One of the most interesting are the chapel spaces at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. So the hospital there is a merger of two hospitals, Deaconess Hospital, which was a United Methodist hospital founded by the deaconesses, and Beth Israel, which was a Jewish hospital. Traditionally, they had two chapels, one Jewish, one Methodist. When you're driving on the Jamaica Way, you can actually see the small Methodist chapel just from your car as you drive by. Mm-hmm. So as the hospital merged, what were they going to do about the chapels? And they decided over time, the staff actually decided, that they wanted these both to be multi-faith spaces to recognize the diversity not just of patients and families, but of staff. So they made some changes to each of the spaces. They removed some pews on the Methodist side of the facility so that Muslims could pray, and they are trying to welcome everyone in. So that's a space certainly that's changed in really creative ways over time.
There are some other places. So the Westgate Mall, the Prudential Center, and the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. I've been there many times. Where is this sacred space?
Right. Every sacred space has a story. At the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, it was her private chapel. It's up on one of the top floors, and she had it built. She wanted to have the space. There is now a mass, I believe, that's held there once a year on her birthday. So that was her sort of private chapel. I believe it was not open to the public until after she passed. Many of the Catholic spaces came out of Cardinal Cushing or Archbishop Cushing's efforts to bring Mass to the workers. So this wasn't just at the airport. It was at the mall. It was at the Prudential Center, at the port. Interestingly, there was actually a chapel at South Station from 1954 until 1972.
Really?
The Archdiocese purchased an air-conditioned movie theater. And in the 60s, this was a big deal in the 50s because you could get sit in an air-conditioned place.
Yeah.
And they had a full-time chaplain who was there. It was Our Lady of the Railways. So for 20 years, there was even a chapel in South Station, mostly, again, for workers and for travelers.
What's next for this project?
So we've thankfully just gotten a grant from Mass Humanities, and we are planning to have a traveling exhibit. We're going to begin by taking some of these photos to three area retirement house facilities, Sherrill House in Jamaica Plain, Hebrew Senior Life, and I'm forgetting one. Newbury Court in Concord to share the images with folks in these places and have some discussion. We're also really eager to bring the photos to other people to do different kinds of displays, conversations, talks, and we encourage people who want to learn more to contact us through our website.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This is Wendy Cage. She is the Wendy Cage. You get that a lot, right?
It's okay.
Professor in sociology at Brandeis University. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Radio Boston.